There were a number of you who have, since last night, said you were excited about tonight's lesson. I'm not sure that it's all excitement about the lesson itself or just seeing if we can really cover, in this time frame, Exodus through Malachi. For those of you who are here for the first time, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, we are covering the story of the Bible, the overall picture of what God is trying to do from Genesis through the book of Revelation. And while I'll be alluding to some passages, we're just going to tell the story of what happens, what God is trying to orchestrate, not only for the people of the Bible, but for you and me today. And I cannot go back and review what we did last night, because if I did that, we'd only get to the end of Genesis and we'd be right where we are again tonight. So, we pick up the story at the beginning of Exodus. Joseph has died. Joseph who brought his people into Egypt. And at that time, I'm sure all of his family would have said, "What a wonderful thing. I mean, here we are in the land of Goshen. And while there's a famine going on back in our homeland, a place where we only lived in tents, we now live in cities, and we now have the favor of Pharaoh." And they did. And after Joseph died, Pharaoh died. And when Pharaoh died, the beginning of Exodus opens with these ominous words: "There arose in Egypt a Pharaoh who did not remember Joseph, nor the things he had done." Cue up the ominous music. It's time now for things to take a dark turn. And the Israelites, who saw only sunshine and basked in the favor of the Egyptians, now become slaves, forced to build store cities of Pithom and Ramses for the pharaohs of Egypt. Now they endure hardships. And this will go on for hundreds of years. These Israelites who had the favor of God now find themselves bereft of God's favor and blessings. They think God has forgotten them, when in fact what is happening is God is both preparing them as a nation, as he is also preparing the nations who occupy the land where he wants his people to be to receive his judgment. The scriptures say that the iniquity of the people of Canaan was not yet full. It's not yet time. Almost. God is saying to his people in his own way, wait for it. Wait for it. It's coming. But the wait is long, and the wait is suffering. And the Israelites, those descendants of Abraham, cry out to their God. And then the scriptures say God heard them, inclined his ear to hear them, and set himself to deliver his people. How? By raising up a deliverer. By raising up a champion. And the beginnings of that champion are so obscure and so marvelous. Pharaoh begins to fear the fact that his slave nation is producing many more men than he himself is producing in his country. And so he orders that all male babies be thrown into the river Nile, that they be destroyed. There is a couple, Amram and Jochebed, who have given birth to a girl, who then give birth to a boy, a little baby that they hide first in the house, and when they can no longer hide him in the house, they make for him a small floating vessel, a basket in which they place the baby and put him among the reeds and bulrushes alongside the river. The older sister is instructed to go back and forth and watch for the child. Not knowing what else to do with him, he is there in the hands of God. A princess of Egypt comes down to the river, sees the basket, and has her women fetch it from the water for her, and finds within that basket a baby. But this is not a Disney story. This is true. She takes that child for her own. And then that older sister, Miriam, says to her, "You're going to need somebody to feed that baby. You need a wet nurse." And she said, "Go fetch me one." And the great part of this story is that the mother of Moses gets to take her child to her breast and nurture it and nourish it until the it becomes a he and the he becomes one in the household of Pharaoh. Now, I'm going to tell you what I believe happened along the way, and I'll tell you why I believe it. Though it's not specifically spoken in the scriptures, it is alluded to that Moses somewhere along the way was told who he was and what he was by his mother, because he will grow up believing he is the deliverer of Israel. He grows up knowing all the ways of Pharaoh's household. He is, for all practical purposes, an Egyptian ruler. Moses' life can be divided up into three sections of 40 years each. Three periods of 40 years each. And this first period of fully 40 years, Moses is in the household of Pharaoh. He is growing up under the tutelage of those great lords. But all this time, he realizes he is associated with those slave people who are doing all that work. And about the age of 40, Moses sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating an Israelite slave. And the scriptures tell us, this is not the way it happened, the idea that Moses became incensed and in a fury struck down the Egyptian. It says he looked around. No one he thought was watching, and he killed the Egyptian and buried his body in the sand. When this story is recounted by Stephen in Acts chapter 8, he adds this phrase as to what Moses was doing. He says of him, he supposed that by that act he was delivering his people. Evidently, the thought of Moses was, my people will now rise up. I will become their leader, and they will follow me, and we will throw off the shackles of Egypt. But it didn't happen that way. Not only were his people unwilling to do that, they misunderstood him. And on the next day, when he tried to break up a fight between a couple of Israelites who were arguing, they turned on him and said, "What are you going to do, kill us like you did the Egyptian?" And he realized nobody understands what he's trying to do. And so he is forced into exile. The next 40 years of his life would appear to be wasted. Here is a man who has been trained in all the political machinations of the Egyptian Empire, the greatest empire in the known world, and he is reduced to watching sheep. For the next 40 years, from age 40 to age 80, Moses is tending sheep. He is now married. He has children. and he is, in his own estimation, just going to live out the rest of his life in exile. Broken dreams, broken plans, a broken man. And how God is working in all of this. For at the age of 80, having been drawing Social Security for the past 10 years or more, this elderly man is called by God to now do what he thought he was going to do at age 40. When he had an inside track, when he was virile and strong, when he still could command the attention of his people, now at age 80, God says, I think you're ready. God didn't want a political pharaoh to lead his people. God wanted a shepherd to guide his people. And so he calls him. And it is Moses who argues with God, saying, I'm not an eloquent man. Anybody that would take God on in a one-on-one debate has got to have some confidence in his verbal skills. But Moses argues, I cannot. Moses says, I cannot do this. I need help. And God says, your brother Aaron is waiting for you. Get back to Egypt. Now, the rest of this story in Egypt, I think I could summarize this way. Imagine that there's a squared boxing ring, and on one side is being announced the gods of Egypt. The god of the Nile, the god of cattle, the god of the sun, the god of the priests, the lord of the flies, the lord of the frogs. These are the gods of Egypt. One after another, they are called up as champions, and they stand in the ring, loosening themselves up. They've got their boxing gloves on, and they're ready to take on whoever it is that will appear on the other side. Whatever polytheistic conglomeration of gods appears, they're ready for them. And then is announced their opposition. Yahweh. Jehovah. The God of the Israelites. The God of a slave people. Not only is it inconceivable that any God who can't even deliver his people from slavery could compete with the gods of Egypt, but there are at least 10 of them and only one of him. How long can he last? Ring the bell, and the God of the Nile steps up. And the Lord God Jehovah afflicts the Nile by turning it to blood. Down goes the God of the Nile. Bring up the God who can take animals and bring them forth from the mud, which looked like a miraculous thing for frogs to do. And God will produce them in such numbers that they become an affliction to the Egyptians. There are frogs in their beds, and frogs in their streets, and frogs in their kneading bowls. Hey, Mom, I want some cereal for breakfast. Go get a bowl. Mom, can we have a bowl that doesn't have a frog in it? Down go the gods of Egypt, one after another. The Lord God takes them on, rests them for his own purposes, and sends them packing. And finally, God says there is one more affliction I will strike the very household of the God, the Pharaoh of Egypt. I will kill his firstborn son. In that last miraculous attack on the gods of Egypt, there is instituted this feast of the Passover, wherein the Israelites are spared from the punishment of the Egyptians by painting above their doorposts and on the lintels of their doors with blood their protective sign that God will not afflict them if they will stay in their houses when he comes over. It is that 10th plague on Egypt that breaks the will of Pharaoh. Pharaoh not only says the Israelites can go, he demands they go. And the Egyptians are so eager for them to go that the Israelites, when they indicate they may want to stay on a few days, pay them to leave. And the scriptures say, thus they plundered the Egyptians. They take with them hands full of gold, earrings and jewelry from the Egyptians. And they leave to go. Where? To go where? Into a desert. But they're confident. They have a great leader. It's Moses. Moses will take them where they need to go. And he does. To the edge of the Red Sea. When they get to the Red Sea and they recognize that behind them are coming the Egyptians, because Pharaoh has now changed his mind, bring them back. They have an army behind them and a sea in front of them, and only Moses to tell them what to do. And that man raises his rod and says, stand still and see the power of the Lord. You can see it played out in any number of movies. And our special effects are pretty wonderful. But it could not have held a candle to the brilliance of that act as those waters became turgid and began to separate and stand up in walls on both sides of the Israelites. Walls, moving walls, not frozen. Moving water. Can you imagine what it must have taken for the first Israelite to step into that pathway between those walls? Having never seen anything like that before. To be able, if they needed to or wanted to reach out and put their fingers into that water and walk through that Red Sea, with those walls standing up so high. There are those who have tried to make that event a natural occurrence. They say it wasn't the Red Sea. It was a body of water called the Reed Sea. It's a very shallow body of water. And there probably were some winds that blew that back a little bit so that the Israelites could go through, and it might have been ankle-deep water as they waded on through to the other side. No miracle here. When one wise man said, no miracle. You mean it's not a miracle that the entire Egyptian army could drown in 2 inches of water? Because the Egyptians plunged into that behind them. And the waters came back into their place and destroyed the army of Pharaoh. Now the Egyptians are gone and the Israelites are in the wilderness, and it looks like everything's good. But I think I can summarize the next 40 years in just a couple of brief sentences, and then we'll take a break. The Israelites are constantly doubting God's ability to save them. But before you're hard on them, I want you to know it was not a matter of they've been without water for 2 hours and they're thirsty. They went days without fresh water. And at times they went days and weeks without fresh meat. And while God provided for them, if you think it was some kind of huge summer camp experience for them, I want to remind you that their family members died in that wilderness. And there were days when they were wandering and they came across places they had already been and wondered, is this right? God was testing them. And yes, they had manna and they had it every day. And which one of us would say, isn't that wonderful? What are we having tomorrow? I can guess. It's manna. Because that's what it was yesterday. And that's what it was last week. And that's what it was last month. And that's what it was last year. And that's what it was last decade. Yes, there were breaks in that. And yes, they wore clothing and shoes that never wore out. God took care of them. Now, I want you to think about that. Wouldn't you just hate it if the night before you left, the only pair of shoes you took were your least favorite and you have to live with them for 40 years? Why didn't I pick my red sandals? God did provide for them. But it was not abundant provision. It was such that made them constantly look to Moses for answers. Constantly had to do those checks of their hearts. Are we going to listen to God? Are we going to do what he says? And when they came to Mount Sinai and received the law from God at that great volcanic eruption called Sinai, smoke belching forth fire, rumbling all the time, God was saying something to them. Don't mess with me. I don't play games. I want you to be my people, but you've got to understand the relationship. This is not a friendship. This is not a relationship of equals. You want to be my people, I'll be your God, but you'll do what I say. And he gave them the commandments. And he gave them a tabernacle. And he gave them a priesthood. And he gave them a system whereby they would remember this. Sin causes death. And they wouldn't just remember it by some mnemonic device or some sermons by preachers or priests. They would remember it this way. When I sin, I'm going to have to take an innocent, pure, helpless lamb or dove or goat, and I'm going to have to slaughter it. Not for the purpose of my eating it for a meal, but slaughter it in what it appears to be a wasteful action and burn it on an altar to God, because when I sin, purity dies. Have you ever wondered why it was that the animals that were animals of sacrifice were animals that you'd really want to have around? I mean, wouldn't it have been easier? We were joking earlier this evening about some other animals and eating them. Wouldn't it have been easier? Wouldn't there almost be a sense of satisfaction if every time you sinned, you got to kill a possum? Or a snake? Or a rat? There'd almost be a sense that we're doing something good. But if you can imagine it for our culture, where we are in an urban setting, it's like God saying, you sinned? Give me your pet rabbit. That soft rabbit with the big doe eyes that never did anything bad to anybody. Take it and slaughter it. Oh, don't just inject it with some lethal fluid. No. Take it and slice its throat and spill its blood and then throw it on an altar and burn it up. And you say, that's so cruel. I mean, that's so traumatic. What is God doing? He is telling you that's what you do to a pure soul when you sin. You destroy it. You make it ugly. You make it useless. And the system of sacrifices that Israel was to keep, those sacrifices were meant to remind them, we can't save ourselves. We need a Savior. And we need a leader. And Moses said, God will raise up a prophet like unto me who will direct you and guide you. And God would provide the sacrifice, like back there in Genesis. God will provide for himself the ram. God is saying something to Israel. It's not just some senseless ritual. It's meant to remind them of the ugliness and the destructiveness of sin. Moses leads them through that wilderness for 40 years. He is now 120 years old. The Bible tells us his vigor was not abated, nor was his eye dim. He is a strong 120-year-old man. And God says to him, because of your sin, you will not go into the land of promise. Go up on Mount Nebo. Look into the land and see it from a distance. And then I'll kill you there. God took Moses' life and buried him where no man could find him. And then God raised up Joshua. Joshua, one of only two men above the age of 20 who was allowed to go into the land of promise. He and Caleb are now the old men of Israel. Everybody else is 20 years old, or was 20 years old and under when they sinned in the wilderness against God. And these two men will lead God's people across the Jordan and into the land of promise. We'll pick up with that story after this song. Well, and Joshua took them across that Jordan River and straight into the jaws of Jericho, that great fortress city of the people of Canaan. And after a most interesting attack plan, 7 days of marching around the city and doing nothing aggressively, on that seventh day, they marched around it, gave a shout, the walls fell down, and Jericho was taken. The people of the land of Canaan are now ripe for the pickings. They have reached that point of iniquity that God says their cup is full. And the Israelites are told, wipe them out. You are God's tool for punishment of these people. The campaign is very simple. Split the land in two, conquer the north, take the south. And within a short period of time, the Israelites are enjoying the profits of victory. They have built their cities. They have established themselves in their tribal portions. And all is well. Not really. The book of Judges is a pretty sordid book. It is a book of continual conflict of Israelites with their neighbors. Why? Because they didn't do what God said. And they didn't wipe out all those peoples. They did not conquer and destroy everybody. They conquered and decided to live with many of them. And so, idolatry crops up in different places among the Israelites. And what happens is God sends in a punishing army to afflict the Israelites in those sections where they are idolatrous. And then they realize what they've done and they cry out to God. And then God brings a deliverer, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson, Shamgar, all those deliverers, and included among them the great Deborah, the judge of Israel, who then brings about a deliverance by calling the people and rallying them together. They drive off their enemies. They become satisfied with what they have. They go back into idolatry. Another nation comes in. They cry out to God. God brings a deliverer. The deliverer responds. The people are brought to safety and back again and again and again and again. And the only thing to remember about the book of Judges is this. It's not always the same dumb people doing the same dumb things. It's different people doing the same dumb things. When you read the book, it looks like, well, there they go again. But it's not always the same ones. Now, that doesn't make it better in the long run because they all suffer for what they do. But at least it's not 15 repetitious acts by the same exact group of people. The last of those judges is Samuel. And Samuel becomes for them not just a deliverer, but a wise ruler, almost a kind of surrogate for God. But it is during his time that the people first start saying, we want kings. We want guys to rule us like the nations around us. I mean, they've got these great potentates who have these men that go before them. And they wear great robes, and they have a dignity about them. We don't have that. And God lets them have their kings. First Saul, then David, then Solomon. And among those three kings, roughly, they rule over the united kingdom of Israel about 40 years each. We're familiar with the stories of Saul and of David and the wisdom of Solomon and the books he wrote. But the one thing we learn about the kings is they exact a price. Not only for their own ineptitude and their own iniquities and their own arrogance. And that would be Saul and David and Solomon. But they also create for Israel this continuing conflict of wanting to be like the nations around them. Last night, I was trying to help you key on this fact. God is shaping a people to be his own. When he picks Abraham, he's trying to say, of all these people, I want to pick just a group of them and focus on them so they can be what I want them to be. In tonight's lesson, throughout all of the Old Testament, what God is trying to do is shape a nation. Let's give them laws. Let's give them regulations. Let's give them parameters in which to live. Let's give them commerce, and let's give them land and responsibility and see what they can become. And Israel fails over and over and over again. Saul, that king who begins with such promise, a man whose stature is great but whose humility appears to be greater. He is the guy who says, if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. But he is convinced by the acclaim of the people to become Israel's first king, a descendant of Kish of the tribe of Benjamin. He is a warrior king. But Saul defends his kingdom with the wiles and ways of man. He doesn't trust God to secure his kingdom. And when this young upstart David comes along, who suddenly finds favor with all the people, you know, if anybody ever wants to write a great song about you, think about the consequences before you let that song become number one in the land. Saul has killed his thousands, they sang. And while Saul smiled, the second line came, and David his 10,000s. Oh, wow. That song was number one on the charts in Israel for so long, Saul couldn't take it. And so he sought to kill David, his son-in-law. We often talk about relationships between sons-in-laws and mothers-in-laws. Doesn't hold at all the fear that David felt for his father-in-law, Saul. Saul is dethroned, and the kingdom is taken from him. And David becomes king, now of the tribe of Judah. And that's significant because of a promise that was made back in the book of Genesis that the scepter would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. But Shiloh is a variation of the word shalom, which is the word for peace. Peace. The scepter will not depart from Judah until peace comes. And what was the message that was brought by the angels to the shepherds in the fields of Bethlehem? Peace on earth among men. And he shall be called, Isaiah said, the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Prince of Peace. Jesus, as we learned Sunday morning in our class from Matthew 1, is a descendant of Judah. He will come from that same lineage as David. Jesus, the son of David, son of Abraham. For the most part, David's kingdom is glorious. The Bible tells us repeatedly he was a man after God's own heart. He wrote beautiful songs and poetry to his God. But even this king also has his problems. On two occasions, he brings God to such distress that in the first, in the case of Bathsheba, God kills the child that would have been born to them. In the second, when David numbers the people to find out what his physical strength of army is going to be, God becomes so distraught about that that he kills 70,000 Israelites in a plague. Those are things to be remembered of the kingdom of David, as well as his accomplishments. And then David's son Solomon comes to the throne. Solomon the wise, the great king who said to God, I cannot lead your people without your help. I don't want riches or gold, just let me lead your people well. And God honors that by letting him do that. Now, Solomon engages in a great deal of political maneuvering. His way of dealing with the nations around him is, if I want peace, marry one of their daughters. And that brings Israel to the brink of rampant idolatry, as those women bring with them their gods. God will not remove the kingdom during the days of Solomon, but when Solomon dies, his son Rehoboam comes to the throne. And then comes before him one whom Solomon had exiled into Egypt. The man's name is Jeroboam, and Jeroboam would be, for all practical purposes, the leader of the ancient Tea Party. He comes to Rehoboam and says, "We're sick of the taxes. We're tired of it. Your father taxed us mercilessly. You got to call a halt to it. The budget's busted, and so are we. And it's time for you to call a halt to all the spending." Well, Rehoboam goes to the old men who had served his father. And those old men say to Rehoboam, "He's right." Now, of course, it's easy for them to acknowledge it's right now. It would have been right in the days of Solomon, but they didn't have the courage to speak then. But they're on their way out. They're collecting their pensions. And they say, "Yeah, do it. Cut the budget. Give those people what they want. There are a lot of them out there." And then he says, "Well, let me consult one more group." And he goes to his friends. And his friends say this, "You've got to show yourself tough. You're going to have to stand up to them. Don't let them push you around. This Tea Party thing is a fly-by-night activity. You just go toe-to-toe with them, and they'll back down." So Rehoboam calls in Jeroboam. He says, "I'll tell you what. Let me tell you where I am. I've thought about this." And he says, you know my daddy had a lot of strength. And if you were to look at his thigh, there's a lot of muscle there in a thigh. I got more power in my little finger than my daddy had in his entire thigh. So you just go back to work, and I'll take care of the government." And Jeroboam utters this phrase. He turns to the people behind him, and he says this, "To your tents, O Israel, we're out of here." And they were. They were gone. But they didn't leave the country. They pulled the country with them. And 10 of those 12 tribal lands defected from Israel and became, because of their size, the nation of Israel. And left behind were two puny tribes, Judah and Benjamin, portions of Simeon that comprised the land of Judah. And in that situation was constant warfare, back and forth, back and forth. Now here's all you need to remember. Israel never had a good king. Not one. I mean, I don't know why they couldn't come up with a single righteous king, but from Jeroboam all the way through to the end of that nation, they had wicked kings. Judah, on the other hand, having their parallel kingdoms and kings, had some good kings and a lot of bad ones. And then somebody had turned good, and then somebody else would be bad after that. And it was a seesaw event for them. For Israel, it was just a downhill roll. For Judah, it was little spikes of righteousness in the midst of valleys of despair. In 722 B.C., Samaria, the capital of Israel, fell. And then some 100 years later, Judah collapsed. They went into respective exiles by the nations that had conquered them. It is just before the fall of those two nations that the prophets come into play. The prophets are sent by God to warn Israel and Judah, and sometimes both, that there is impending doom if they don't turn things around. And there will be some temporary turns, but not enough to keep them from plunging off into the ravine. And then when they go into exile, there are some prophets who speak to them in their exile and say to them, you better get faithful to God. He's going to bring us back out of this exile, and we better be ready for it and turn our hearts to God. That's the essence of the message of the prophets. Now, what lessons do we get from tonight's study? What benefit is there in the things that we've looked at historically in the rest of the Old Testament that we've gone through this evening? Well, let me just suggest four lessons for you. Four things to note about this section of Scripture that I think is going to be helpful tomorrow night. That statement that God made in Deuteronomy, or that God made through Moses in Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 and 18, God will raise up a prophet like me. Moses understands the Israelites and the people of God generally are going to need a leader like Moses, not like Saul, not like Solomon, like Moses. Secondly, God establishes a rule for his people. He always does. Ramifications, punishments for those who disobey, rewards for those who do the right thing. God is always wanting his people to live by laws, not laws unto themselves. We see what happens with that in the book of Judges. But laws that God gives, he's setting them up even here in the Old Testament for a rule in their hearts by his will, purifying the land and establishing a prototype of his kingdom to come. Third, God punishes sin. Always God punishes sin. Even Moses, as great as he was and as favored of God as he was, a man who the scriptures say spoke to God face to face as with a friend, was not allowed to go into the land of promise because he sinned. Even David, a man after God's own heart, who lived his life for God, who wrote some of the most beautiful statements about God ever written, was punished for his sin. Israel, the nation that comprised the largest portion of his people, was punished for its sin. And even Judah, semi-faithful Judah, was punished for its sin. God always punishes sin. And fourth, throughout all of these chapters and books of the Old Testament, God is dropping clues about the king to come. Throughout, in Moses, in the sacrifices, in David, in the prophets, Isaiah speaks of him, Malachi speaks of him, Micah speaks of him. God is dropping hints. Why? Why is he doing that? So that when Jesus comes, they'll go back and pick up those things. Oh, that's who you're talking about. There's the one. Who is he? We'll talk about him and his people tomorrow night as we continue in our journey through the greatest story ever.